Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Bryant Mair Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, there's a strange intersection today between Speaker of the House Paul Ryan's retirement announcement and the latest development in the Trump investigations. The New York Times reports today that the search warrant on Trump attorney Michael Cohen's home and office and hotel room this week included documents related to the Access Hollywood tape, which came out a month before the election in 2016, with Trump boasting about grabbing women's genitals and other sexual assault. Well, the FBI is apparently looking for evidence that Cohen or Trump may have broken the law in some way in attempts to suppress that tape from going public. At the time, Paul Ryan said this.
His comments are not anywhere in keeping with our party's principles and values. I am not going to defend Donald Trump. Not now, not in the future.
I'm not going to defend Donald Trump. Not now, not in the future. Now, that was consistent with other things Ryan had said during the campaign, like this, when Trump announced his intention to impose a complete and total ban after Trump accused a judge of likely bias just because he's Mexican-American.
Claiming a person can't do their job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment.
And Ryan said this when Trump announced his intention to impose a complete and total ban on Muslims entering the United States.
What was proposed yesterday is not what this party stands for. And more importantly, it's not what this country stands for.
So not what this country stands for. He's not going to defend Trump today or in the future. But that last clip was December 2015. Yesterday, in announcing his retirement from Congress, Paul Ryan said this about the presidency of Donald Trump.
I'm grateful to the president for giving us this opportunity to do big things to get this country on the right track. So the fact that he gave us this ability to get all this stuff done makes me proud of the accomplishments that I've been a contributor to. Makes me satisfied that I've made a big difference, and he's given us that chance. So I'm grateful to him for that, and that's really how I see it.
So part of Ryan's legacy will be Donald Trump accommodator, despite believing the president is in fundamental ways racist and not about what this country stands for, and having said out loud that he would not defend the president then or in the future. At least there was this exchange yesterday with a reporter.
On the president, he has been openly talking about firing Bob Mueller, potentially firing the deputy attorney general. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts haven't changed. I think they should be allowed to do their jobs. We have a rule of law in this country, and that's a principle we all uphold. I have no reason to believe that that's going to happen. I have assurances that's not, because I've been talking to people in the White House about it.
So it remains to be seen if Ryan and other congressional Republican leaders will actually stop Trump if Trump takes the advice he's reportedly getting from Steve Bannon and others and tries to fire Mueller or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who is Mueller's boss. So we will start at the intersection of Paul Ryan's retirement and the investigations today with our first guest, Gabe DeBenedetti, who just switched news organizations, leaving Politico and joining New York Magazine as a national political correspondent. His first article on New York's Daily Intelligencer politics site is out today, and it's called After Ryan's Exit, Big Money Donors Turn to War for the Senate. Hi, Gabe. Welcome back to WNYC. You look like the same guy to me.
I haven't changed that much.
What's your role going to be with New York Magazine?
I'll still be writing the big national political stories and coming on whenever you'll have me.
So what did you make of Ryan's evolution over time on how he speaks about Trump?
Well, obviously, this was a deal that Ryan made with himself, which is a lot of his allies have said over the last few days and really the last few hours even, which is this is clearly not a situation he planned to find himself in. And a lot of them keep reminding us, the national press corps, listen, he didn't want to be speaker in the first place. He didn't want to be in this situation. But, you know, they understand why it's hard to have some sympathy for that. Of course, he did find himself in this situation, and he did continue to apologize for Donald Trump, even when he said he was not going to, simply by not condemning him once he was the speaker and once President Trump was president. the line that he used over and over was, I don't read the tweets. I'm not going to talk about that stuff. That's not important. Obviously, there are some people that hope that that changes now, that in his final days as a lame duck speaker, he'll speak out a bit more against Trump. But we'll see. I don't know if that's too realistic.
So listeners, your thoughts and questions are welcome on the legacy of Paul Ryan, the implications of his coming retirement, or the latest in the Trump world investigations. 212-433-WNYC for Gabe DeBenedetti now with New York Magazine, 212-433-9692. What did you make of Ryan seeming to hold firm yesterday on thinking Mueller and Rosenstein should be allowed to do their jobs?
Well, it was a good example of how we haven't seen him change his tack on things like that. He said, listen, I've gotten assurances from the White House, from people inside the White House, he says, that Mueller's firing is not seriously being talked about. But of course, we know that this president changes his mind quite frequently, especially on things like this. And he has mused publicly about firing Mueller. So Ryan saying this was obviously intended to calm people down and say, we're not talking about a real issue here. Let's focus on some things that are actually happening. The unfortunate reality, though, is that we don't know if that's true. It may be true that White House advisors are saying Trump isn't talking about it or Trump isn't going to fire Mueller, but Trump can't predict if Trump is going to fire Mueller. He's talked about it. He's mused about it. It's out in the open.
This might be too speculative, but so far, the Republican leaders in Congress, Ryan in the House, McConnell in the Senate, and their deputies don't seem serious about passing any kind of legislation to prevent Mueller or Rosenstein from being fired. But they do seem to say things, especially in McConnell's case, like this is not necessary yet, and implying that they might react in some way if Trump actually does it or tries to do it. Do you have any impression as a national politics reporter what, if anything, they would actually do?
Yeah, there is actually some legislation that is being talked about. It has not yet been considered, but it's being talked about in committee right now in Washington. This is there are two pieces of legislation intended to protect Mueller, essentially codifying the idea that Donald Trump cannot end the special counsel's investigation unilaterally. And those are, you know, that was two different pieces of legislation merged over the last week into one, put forth by Cory Booker, Chris Coons, Tom Tillis, and Lindsey Graham. That's two Democrats and two Republicans. And there are some leaders in the Senate who have said that they're willing to look at this a little bit more closely. Of course, what many leaders have said in public is, this isn't realistic, let's not talk about this in the first place. But you have had some rank-and-file members of the Senate and many in the House, even some Republicans, say, listen, if Trump were to try and get rid of Mueller, that would be an impeachable offense. Of course, there's a whole lot of ifs here and no actual substance yet.
What do you make of the report that the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York is looking for documents pertaining to the Access Hollywood tape? It's the first time the Access Hollywood tape is being mentioned in conjunction with any criminal investigation.
Yeah, that was a bit of a curveball. We all remember that as a huge political moment, but not necessarily as a legal one. But there are questions, of course, about what happened after that. Was that some sort of moment where people in the Trump organization said, we need to get this storyline under control? Because, of course, if you remember, there's been a lot of reporting that the probe into Michael Cohen, the president, president's lawyer, has to do with his arrangement of a deal with Stormy Daniels and with other women. And so that all happened after the Access Hollywood tape came out, after that became a national storyline. But again, as you said earlier, it's very striking. I remember very well when Paul Ryan stood up and said, we're not going to defend this guy anymore. And it sort of is appropriate that this is all coming full circle now.
How clear is it, or what's even the informed speculation in your national politics correspondent circles about what kind of crime they might be investigating with respect to the Access Hollywood tape and Michael Cohen?
Well, there's a whole lot of speculation, and obviously I don't want to go too far out on a limb here, but there's a lot of talk about basically whether by arranging some sort of deal with Daniels or other women, there was some sort of in-kind donation that was not reported to the campaign. That would be a Federal Election Commission violation, which can actually be fairly serious. Some people might remember that playing a fairly large role in the case of John Edwards about a decade ago. But, you know,
when he was running for the Democratic nomination for president and he got caught having that affair.
That's right.
And I guess there was, what, campaign donations by himself to himself for money that he paid to try to suppress that information from
coming
out.
Obviously, this is all very complicated, but that is essentially – that's essentially the story. And
but
the question,
he got acquitted in that trial.
Sure,
right?
But the question here would be whether Cohen's actions in paying Daniels or other women – to not talk about this were directly pegged to the election because, of course, this did happen in Election Day, and therefore whether that counts as a campaign activity, which is a fairly serious offense. But it's unclear if that's exactly what they're looking at here. I want to be clear that we don't know that. This is still speculation, but pretty serious speculation.
And it is pretty extraordinary for a prosecutor to execute a search warrant on the lawyer for somebody who they're interested in, never mind that it's the lawyer for the president of the United States, no less. So if they're going to breach attorney-client privilege, then what we hear from the legal experts is that they think, in order to do that, they must be convinced, we don't know yet if they are, that there was some kind of fraud or other crime that Cohen and Trump were cooking up together.
Well, and we should talk not just about the attorney-client privilege question here, which obviously the president has tweeted saying, is that a thing of the past? What's the situation here? Of course, there is precedent for breaking that. But the reality here is that there's very few people on earth that are closer to Donald Trump himself in terms of a lot of the sensitive activities that he's done both in the business and personal realms over the last few decades. So we don't know the full extent of what the FBI went looking for with Michael Cohen. Obviously, the activity with these women is a big part of it. But Cohen has been the president's personal lawyer for a very long time and has had a very big role in a lot of the president's business deals overseas. He has, of course, come up when it comes to the question of building or speculation about the question of building a Trump Tower in Moscow, for example. So there was likely that the FBI got a lot of material from Cohen. We don't know yet what exactly they're looking for or what the full extent that they're looking for is.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Donna in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Donna.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to do the if game again with Mueller. If Mueller gets fired, we now know that the Eastern District gets the Cohen and the women and the hush money. But what happens to the collusion and the obstruction of justice? Has Mueller possibly farmed that out to anybody? Could he farm it out or some part of it to somebody, let's say Schneiderman? It just seems like we reach this wall every time we try to think beyond it.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one that I think a lot of Democrats in particular on Capitol Hill are trying to figure out right now. The answer is it's certainly possible that pieces of this investigation have been, as you said, farmed out to other investigative or law enforcement agencies. But the short answer is we don't know that yet. Obviously, the Mueller investigation and Mueller team has been extremely good at not leaking any of its internal machinations. So that remains to be seen. But that's obviously a huge concern.
Boris in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hello, Boris.
Hi, how are you, Brian? Thanks again for having me on.
Sure.
So I just wanted to make a point. So the WikiLeaks dumped the DNC stolen hacked emails about an hour or two or a couple of hours after the Hollywood Access tape came out. And I bet the FBI raid had something to do with the communication between Trump and Cohen right after that Hollywood Access tape came out, seeing maybe there was some kind of a green light, go for it, go tell them to release the emails.
That's pretty interesting speculation. And again, it is just speculation, but those are more dots that could be connected. For people who don't remember the infamous day of October 7th, 2017, it was a Friday. The Access Hollywood tape was released late in the afternoon. That started to dominate political talk around the presidential campaign immediately. But as Boris reminds us, right after that, the first hacked John Podesta emails, presumably hacked by Russia and obtained and then released by WikiLeaks, were released. Immediate damage control with a piece of dirt or lots of pieces of dirt that they apparently had waiting for the right moment, and then drip, 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 the Podesta emails continue to emerge.
And an important thing about that day, which I still remember vividly, that people now forget about frequently, is actually what happened even before the Access Hollywood tape came out, was the Obama administration came out with its conclusion with a number of its national security pieces of the national security apparatus saying that Russia was trying to, they were conclusively saying Russia was trying to interfere in the election. So you have that coming out publicly for the first time, followed by the Access Hollywood tape, followed by the beginning of the WikiLeaks drip, drip, drip. We know that Mueller's looking into that.
So where it might connect with the Russia investigation, as the caller suggests, is that if they're already looking at possible collusion between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks, and we know they're looking at Roger Stone, informal Trump advisor at that time, who claims to have conversations with Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, but now denies it, and had seemed to tweet something around that time that indicated that John Podesta somehow was going to be in the tank. If all of that connects to the Access Hollywood tape in terms of Trump himself, or maybe at least Michael Cohen being in on the timing, well, that's how the actual Russia investigation could potentially link up with any attempt to illegally suppress the Access Hollywood tape or any stories by Stormy Daniels and other women. So it's a tangled web we weave, Gabe.
And a very long-running one here. And, you know, to take it back to what we were talking about earlier with how Republicans on Capitol Hill are feeling about this, especially with respect to the Paul Ryan question, one of the reasons that they're particularly concerned today is that Paul Ryan's exit does not portend good things for the midterms for them. But what they're also concerned about is they have no idea when, if or when, Mueller is going to come out with some sort of report here. Most people assume it will be before the midterms. But remember, you have the White House. The White House has been saying for a long time, well, they're wrapping up what they're doing. You know, this will be all over soon. The line out of the White House for almost a year there, or for months, I should say, was they'll have it done by Thanksgiving. Well, it's been almost 5 months since Thanksgiving, and obviously it's not anywhere closer to done as far as we know, if the FBI is still conducting raids on the president's confidants.
Gabriel DeBenedetti, national politics correspondent for New York Magazine, with us here on The Brian Lehrer Show this morning. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number. And Judy in Chelsea, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Would you guests please comment on this division, as I see it, within Ryan's politics or character, where on the one hand, he spoke out against Trump's racism. On the other hand, he is a reactionary. I consider anybody who wants to destroy Medicare not just a conservative, but a reactionary. So where do you place him politically? Where do you see his legacy?
And let me play a clip to further illustrate your point, and then we'll discuss it. You say he wants to destroy Medicare. He certainly would not put it that way. But at his news conference yesterday, he said that his biggest accomplishment was getting this big tax reform or tax cut bill through Congress. And then he got this follow-up question.
However, you're not sticking around for its biggest consequence, which is trillion-dollar deficits, as far as the Congressional Budget Office's eye can see.
Yeah.
What's your response to that?
So entitlement reform is the one thing that the one other great thing that I've spent most of my career working on. I'm extremely proud of the fact that the House passed the biggest entitlement reform bill ever considered in the House of Representatives. Do I regret the fact that the Senate did not pass this? Yes. But I feel from all the budgets that I've passed, normalizing entitlement reform, pushing the cause of entitlement reform, and the House passing entitlement reform, I'm very proud of that fact. But yeah, of course, more work needs to be done. And it really is entitlements. That's where the work needs to be done. And I'm going to keep fighting for that.
It really is entitlements, Gabe. That's where the work needs to be done, meaning he wants to cut or otherwise change Medicare and Social Security.
That's right. And this is for this reason, this is why the tale of Paul Ryan is one of the most telling tales about modern conservatism in national politics. Remember, he really came onto the national scene in a real way in 2012 when Mitt Romney made him his running mate during that presidential election. And he was chosen because he was seen as sort of a conservative activist who really worked on this stuff. You know, the other finalists to be Romney's running mate, think about establishment figures like Rob Portman or Bob McDonald, people we don't think about really these days. And now Paul Ryan, of course, is thought of as the establishment because he has in many ways embodied the party moving to the right on a lot of these issues over the last half decade or so. But, you know, as to your question, the divide between the way that he talks about entitlement reform and tax reform and the way that he talks about Donald Trump really does expose that these are two totally different issues. You have a lot of people who have been surprised when someone like him votes with the president so frequently, but also is willing to sometimes condemn him. Well, the reality is all of these people are still Republicans, and they're going to vote for tax reform, whether or not Donald Trump likes it. But what I think a lot of Republicans and certainly a lot of Democrats really didn't like is that they felt that Paul Ryan was being applauded by the pundit class, shall we say, for standing up to Trump. But he really wasn't doing that so much once he was speaker. He was saying things like, I'll let the tweets speak for themselves. I'm just focused on tax reform.
And one way that Trump actually stood up to the Republican establishment when he was running was to say he was going to protect Medicare and Social Security. Well, now we have two of the three legs of a situation that might lead to Paul Ryan's dream coming true and Congress seriously taking up cuts to Social Security and Medicare because they passed a big tax cut, which takes money out of the federal budget. The Congressional Budget Office has now projected a $1 trillion deficit. This is other big news this week that we haven't talked about yet on the show. A full $1 trillion deficit, I think, for the first time ever for just one fiscal year, mm-hmm. for the 2019 fiscal year. And so that could put new pressure on Congress to renew their deficit hawkishness. And if they're not going to bring more money into the system because they just cut taxes, maybe go after Medicare and Social Security after all.
Certainly. And as this relates to the Trump question, one of the reasons that this is such an interesting moment is that no one will say this out loud on Capitol Hill because it's not a politically popular thing to say right now. But one of Ryan's big successes is being a member of the Republican leadership that really got Donald Trump to govern as essentially a traditional Republican when it comes to major policy issues like this. Obviously, they're not dealing with the deficit. But in terms of, as you said, trying to repeal Obamacare, which obviously failed, but going through tax reform and trying to get started a serious entitlement reform, at least as Paul Ryan conceives of it, that's what a President Jeb Bush would have done as well.
Would President Trump sign a Social Security or Medicare cut bill after the way he ran? He does. I mean, I know Trump is all over the place and we can't take him literally on anything, but he's also running. He's also governing in a way in which I think it's fair to say he's trying to keep his big promises, which means being anti-immigration, which means going after China on trade, and it could mean keeping Medicare and Social Security in their current form.
Well, it's sort of a moot question. It's a good question intellectually, but of course, he's unlikely to have to sign anything like that. It's unlikely that anything like that could pass the Senate, especially in a midterm year. But that's one of the great questions that someone like Paul Ryan has been going to sleep asking themselves for the last 1 or 2 years at this point. Of course, we know that the president really does listen to sort of the last person who talks to him. And if Paul Ryan or Kevin McCarthy or someone else like that on the House side, who has been sort of a hawk on these issues, is successful in becoming the last person in the president's ear on these issues, then absolutely. But when you look at something, for example, like the spending bill that he signed, that the president signed just 2 weeks ago or so, or 3 weeks ago now, we know that he signed it because he was told that he was supposed to sign this. And then someone else got in his ear and he said, wait, this goes against everything that I campaigned on. So you do see this conflict playing out in real time.
Melissa in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Gabe DiBenedetti from New York Magazine. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I noticed your guest just mentioned a hypothetical President Bush. And I was wondering whether there was any follow-up when Billy Bush was so key in the Access Hollywood tape, if anyone investigated whether there was something from the Bush campaign connection there.
Practiced in the art of the segue, Melissa in Westchester, from a potential President Bush to cousin Billy Bush and his role in the Access Hollywood tape. Gabe, any thought?
I don't remember. I remember certainly some speculation to that effect at the time, but nothing came of it. And certainly that was a moment in the campaign when former candidates such as Jeb Bush really were not talking out at all. They were sort of keeping their head down and saying, Trump is Trump, and I don't want anything to do with this anymore.
Melissa, thank you. Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. I have a question about what's been going on in Wisconsin and Ryan's resignation. I think there was recently an election for Supreme Court judge in Wisconsin, which was won by the Democrat. Do we know how Ryan's district voted in that Supreme Court election? Also, recently there's been litigation to force Governor Scott Walker to hold special elections to fill some vacancies in the state legislature, which he was trying to hold back from doing. And then I think the Wisconsin redistricting from 2010 has been challenged. So do any of these things fit into Ryan's decision-making?
Great questions, Elizabeth. And on the first one, that Supreme Court judge election, which not many people in the country paid all that much attention to, that actually flipped a state Supreme Court seat from Republican to Democrat. So that's, you know, another one of those possible bellwether elections that have taken place recently, plus the other Wisconsin developments that Elizabeth mentions.
Yeah, Wisconsin is actually one of these absolutely fascinating places right now politically. It's sort of the center, one of the centers of political of the political universe. Let's preface all this by saying it's highly unlikely that Paul Ryan bowed out because he was afraid of losing re-election. It is true that there is someone and maybe two people running against him this time who might be more real than before. And it is true that Wisconsin does seem to be sort of the center of some liberal backlash against Donald Trump. But Ryan is likely to have been very, very strong in his re-election campaign. Not necessarily a shoe-in, but very strong. All of that said, Wisconsin is certainly a place where we've seen, not just with the Supreme Court race, but in a series of local special elections over the last few months, huge turnout from Democrats. Ryan's district itself is still fairly Republican, not as Republican as it once was, but fairly Republican. But after there have been all these special elections that have swung hard towards Democrats and where you've seen really high Democratic turnout, Scott Walker, who's of course the governor out there and a staunch conservative, has been trying to say, listen, Republicans, we need to pay attention. He's been tweeting this. He's been going on TV saying this. He's been saying, you need to start giving us a lot more money and a lot more time or else we're going to get swamped. Important thing to remember here is that Scott Walker himself is running for re-election in November and for the first time, maybe not the favorite.
Richardson in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. How are you? This is my very first time in this program.
And I'm so glad you called. Welcome in.
Yes. Well, I listen to politics, American politics, and, you know, I'm for a native Haitian. But my question was very simple. Is there any way the minority in the House or in the Senate can find a way? In other words, does the Constitution provide any option to the minorities in order to bring impeachment to the against the president, since the majority will never budge about bringing up impeachment in the Ethics Committee, because this is overwhelmingly evident that impeachment should have been happening already. And there's no way. Since I know there are footnotes, when there is a law, there's always another law that gives a way to certain things. I don't know if you understand the nature of my question.
I do. It's and you're a smart man to look for the loopholes in the law since they exist in so many laws. I think, however, that the answer is no, because it's a matter of pure politics, and they would need a majority of votes in the House in order to bring impeachment and launch the trial of the president. On whether or not he would be removed from office, which would take place in the Senate if he's impeached by the House. But that brings us back to Paul Ryan's resignation or retirement at the end of this term, and whether and part of what's at stake, right? And part of how both parties have to figure out how to run in November with control of the House and potential impeachment at stake.
Absolutely. It's a massive question, and one of the reasons that House Republicans were so concerned yesterday is that Paul Ryan has really been the face of a lot of their efforts to keep the House in Republican hands. And his stepping aside to a lot of people, even if he insists this is not the case, sent the message that, well, going to be really hard, if not impossible at this point, to keep the House Republican. But one tactic that you have seen from a lot of Republicans and some Democrats, but primarily Republicans at this point, is attempting to get higher turnout from their conservative voters by essentially saying, if Democrats are to win the House, they will, on day one, impeach Donald Trump. And at this point, obviously, there are a lot of Republicans that don't want to see that. But we'll see how much of a tactic this becomes towards November.
Right. Well, we've seen there was an article in the New York Times the other day about Republicans getting ready to run on an anti-impeachment platform, and whether Democrats, who I think are being warned by Schumer and Pelosi not to run on impeachment, but then it's being used potentially by the Republicans to say, no matter what the Democratic candidates for Congress say, they're going to bring impeachment charges if they get the majority in the House or impeachment proceedings. And therefore, we have to elect Republicans in order to stop them. That might be an interesting dynamic in the fall campaigns.
Absolutely. And you do have leaders of the Democratic Party. No one saying on the record, hey, guys, don't talk about impeachment, but certainly saying behind closed doors, listen, if you need to talk about this, talk about it in your primary, if that's the way to get past other Democrats. But if you're trying to win over middle-of-the-road voters who simply want to hear about how you're going to make their lives better, don't talk about impeachment. That's not what they want to hear.
Which brings us back to Paul Ryan and the question of whether his announced retirement and his new lame duck status is going to hurt the Republicans' efforts to keep the majority in the House of Representatives. And here's what he said yesterday about that in his news conference.
I gave it some consideration, but I really do not believe whether I stay or go in 2019 is going to affect a person's individual race for Congress. I really don't think a person's race for Congress is going to hinge on whether Paul Ryan's Speaker or not.
Think that's true?
It's certainly a good question. The reality is the reason that they need him as Speaker is one of the main reasons is that he's sort of a fundraising dynamo for the party, and having him as Speaker really does help them raise enough money for a lot of these folks. But whether that part is true or not, there was a signal, and talking to a lot of Republican donors yesterday, a lot of them saw this as a signal that they should give up on the House and start paying attention to trying to keep the Senate, which should be a lot easier for them.
And that brings us to your article on New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer today. After Ryan's exit, big money donors turn to war for Senate. What did you see?
Well, the Senate has not been the central battleground for a very long time here, particularly because it would seem that the House was more likely to flip, but also that Republicans are so on offense in the Senate right now. There are 10 Democratic senators who have to run for re-election in November in states that Donald Trump won in 2016, including 5 of those in states that he won by double digits. That would seem like an opportunity for Republicans to pad their lead in the Senate. But of course, with the national winds blowing the other way, there is a little bit of panic now in the Republican ranks saying, we don't think we're going to lose the Senate, but guys, it's time to start worrying about this.
But the implication, or one implication of your article, is that there are some Republican leaders or some Republican donors who are getting ready to give up on keeping the House as a lost cause and shifting most of the money to the Senate, where they only do have a slim majority as well, to play defense only in that way, or primarily in that
way. That's exactly right. I quote one donor, Dan Eberhardt, on the record saying, I think the House is gone. It's time to focus on the Senate. And then in the story, I also include a quote from one of Mitch McConnell's top former advisors, a man named Scott Jennings, essentially saying, donors are reading this, Paul Ryan stepping aside, as a clear signal that it is time to not focus on the House. And McConnell has said, if the House is gone, we need to focus on the Senate, because the winds are shifting in one way across the country, whether it's a Senate race or a House race. And Republicans need to not only try and win all of those seats that are held by Democrats, but if we're going to look at the individual states, they also have to defend seats that might be tougher to defend than they might expect in Arizona, in Nevada, in Tennessee. And yesterday, I almost couldn't believe my ears, but I heard Democrats trying to talk somewhat credibly about winning races in Texas and Mississippi. These are not races that Democrats would be seriously competing for in any other year.
Gabriel DeBenedetti, New York Magazine national political correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you.